first session of an hour will be an hour of asking questions on the written submissions, other than the Shaw submission, which is in the afternoon meeting. We'll open up, we'll go round, each member of the select committee will ask one question in turn, and we'll go round until we round up the hour, and then there'll be a period at the end to ask anyone present that has made a submission, if we have some questions specifically for them, to come and answer them, if our advisors are unable to answer those questions in that hour's session. Right.
I'll get away of data on my mobile. I'll do it off my work laptop. There's a disconnect and reconnect.
Okay. So I think if we go around asking questions, I think perhaps if we start with Pete. Pete, do you have any questions on the written evidence?
Not specifically, Roger. I've read through them all. I did have some questions of my own, but they've been superseded by the questions in the written evidence. So I'm quite content to let the not to try and elaborate on that.
Okay. We'll move on to Gavin.
No, very much like Pete, I've read through everything, and my main questioning will come in the later session.
Right. Jack?
I think my first one's more of a comment rather than a question, but probably seek some clarification, possibly from David or possibly Davina. It was on the second point of the petition, and it's been raised in several of the submissions about the domestic tariffs, that if Starlink had given regulatory approval, it then goes on to discuss sort of domestic tariffs, potential negotiations with FIG, the lowering of costs. And I think it just felt important probably to try and separate those two things, because my understanding is that they're not linked, and where if the select committee are to make a recommendation to give regulatory approval to Starlink and it is then granted, that does not guarantee any level of domestic tariff for the end consumer. That is for Starlink and the end consumer to agree on, for Starlink to set the tariff and that to be the rate that the consumers must pay. So that I think it was just to want to try and maybe separate out some of the comments made in a number of submissions that sort of allude to if we give approval, that will result in a lower cost of Starlink, and then therefore a lower cost of internet services overall for people that want to access it, and that isn't necessarily linked to the point of giving them regulatory approval. So I think it was just important to probably to highlight that. That was my understanding of everything we've talked about so far, that they need to probably be separated out.
Sure. Do you want to answer?
Thank you, Chair. Obviously, there would be likely to be a licence fee if regulatory approval were to be given to Starlink having a licence, were Starlink to apply for it. My understanding is they haven't yet done so. And the licence fee would be set by FIG, but commercial rates that would be charged to users in the Falklands would be a matter for the commercial organisation, Starlink in this case, to set. I think where people have made submissions saying it would be cheaper, their assumption is that based on charges they've seen that Starlink levy in other areas. But of course we always do have to bear in mind that the Falklands is more remote and that can lead to additional charges. I don't know if David Rogerson, our technical expert, wants to add anything to that, David?
I don't think so, Davina. You've expressed it very well. There is no certainty, but the suggestion and certainly the experience of other jurisdictions is that if Starlink has its own license, the domestic tariffs are lower than the roaming tariffs that they use.
Okay. Yes. Leona.
Thank you. I had a similar question actually, because I think it is important to clarify, and thank you, David and Davina, for that, because I think some of these submissions also do make reference to or suggest that were Starlink given regulatory approval, that then government would negotiate the package prices with them. I think it's important to be clear that we don't believe that's the case. But on another area, Davina, perhaps it's for you, but from a legal perspective, what are the risks of deregulated internet provision with regards to individual security and safeguarding and potentially national security that is raised in one or two of the submissions?
Right. I mean, David can probably answer some of that better than I can, but it might be helpful if I referred to an explanation we got from Stuart Walker, Crown Council Prosecution, in relation to a specific query that was raised, saying there might be problems obtaining evidence if this proposed deregulation took place. And what Stuart said, and I'll read it out, the short explanation is that internet service providers, so those services which transmit data over the internet, can hold data which is relevant to law enforcement operations. This data can be accessed by law enforcement agencies using appropriate routes, such as disclosure requests, court orders, and requests for mutual legal assistance, even if the service provider is based outside the jurisdiction. Generally speaking, the data held by companies providing transmission services is limited, because although they transmit data, they are unlikely to store data content, such as electronic messages, images, banking information, etc. This data may be stored by the companies providing the internet-based service, such as social media companies, internet search companies, banking organisations, etc., rather than the companies transmitting the data. In the Falkland Islands, it is unlikely that the use of Starlink to transmit data will make any significant difference to law enforcement operations. So, does that answer your question?
It does, thank you.
I don't know if David would want to add anything to that. I think we're getting shaken
out. No, I think Stuart's made it very clearly there.
Yeah. Okay. Mark.
Yeah, so I mean, I've got quite a lot of questions, but not necessarily for the stage, and I think so some of my questions will come out of shore, some will come in perhaps a later session with the regulator when he's back in the islands and attending. But that said, I think I'd ask perhaps David for some sort of technical clarity around I'd just like to thank everyone for their submissions as well. There were a lot and varied. So, David, if I may, could I just ask you what your technical perspective is on looking at Chris Gare's statement that it's virtually impossible to use infotainment streaming services such as Netflix and YouTube in SD. I mean, this doesn't seem to be my experience, but I wonder if I could get your technical view on that.
It's a little difficult for me to comment on that, not being in the Falkland Islands and trying to use those particular applications. I think they clearly are bandwidth intensive, and they require, in some cases, low latency communications, which are both limitations, are limited within the offerings of Shure at present. So I think there's evidence that these services are being used and are being used reasonably effectively in some circumstances, but there are also times when there's a lot of buffering, when the service stops performing, particularly probably in camp. So experience, from what I understand, is quite varied. But it certainly isn't impossible to use those applications.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thanks. Is Tez joined us? Or?
Tez, did you want to say anything? We've also got John on the line.
Oh, right.
Hi, thank you, Chair, and apologies for joining long distance. I will try and speak a little bit slower than normal so that it can be clear. I think the merits and certainly the sentiments behind the petition seem to draw to this need for improved competitiveness greater resiliency was part of some of the written submissions that, really I think can be possibly pulled out a little bit more, not just for things which have already been mentioned by Emily Roberts, for example, being cybersecurity and things like that, but services particularly around the islands, there has been an expectation that a universal provision or some kind of service expectation is across the whole Falkland Islands, and whether that can be currently met in terms of the current provider, and whether enabling a more affordable additional provider will improve resilience and safety, importantly, and safety across the islands. And the other social benefits and the other economic benefits were also pulled out in the written submission, but that point for island-wide resiliency certainly be something I'd like to get into later with the current provider.
Perhaps, David, perhaps, do you have any comments on that?
Well, I think it's true that there's greater resilience if you have options of different communication platforms, and that in itself will increase safety, because there, if one network's down, there's another option. So, yes, undoubtedly, that's a correct statement.
Okay, thank you very much. Anyone else? John, would you like to?
John, do you have any questions?
Thank you, Sheree. Nothing. I'm in listening mode at the moment. Thank you very much.
Okay, right, we're around again. Gavin, you didn't have. Pete.
I think slightly again, just more a comment on submissions. It's raising a number of them about the potential benefits for health services, and I think based on the questions of this select committee, it's important that that probably is also separated and not regarded as a potential benefit of reducing the licence fee, because my understanding, which Davina or David can probably confirm, as FIG, the main and I think probably in most cases the sole provider of all health services in the Falklands, is exempt from the requirement for a licence. There is no need to. The impact of reducing a licence doesn't impact FIG and its ability to use Starlink to improve health services. So I think the arguments made in some submissions about the benefits of Starlink for health in the Falklands are not relevant to the arguments of this. Yes, I do apologise. But whether or not that would be a reasonable thing to do, to discount that those arguments that Starlink would benefit health services in the Falklands, because FIG is exempt from the requirement to have a licence and pay the fee.
If I could respond to that, Chair. Well, you're absolutely right, FIG is exempt, and FIG is the main provider of services. When I read through the submissions, I was thinking people might be talking about them wanting the ability to consult with, say, a doctor or a nurse practitioner who's within KEMH. And so what they may be saying is, well, we could do that if we, the patient, had better internet provision. We would feel more comfortable arranging an appointment online at 10 o'clock in the morning or whatever, knowing that we had a more secure service. So I think it would be reasonable to bear that in mind as a relevant criteria. And it may be, if you have anyone here who is from camp and who put that in their submission as a point, that you might want to see if they want to clarify that in the session you've set aside with time for members of the public who are present to be able to comment.
Okay. I think that point is made. That important point about people, individuals being able to access, whether it's emergency services or health services in an emergency, particularly those people in camp, is an important one that's made in several submissions. I think, like you said, where I think there is an example in one submission that where it gave the case where their phone lines had gone down, they didn't have access to a mobile signal, and at the same time their internet service had gone down, and at the time their wife was in Stanley about to give birth to their first child. So. In that situation, having a backup that would allow them to communicate with Stanley would have been a very important thing. So I think, yeah, I agree with that part of it, that use by individuals for contacting, whether it's emergency services or the health service, is very important, and I think a strong argument for certainly people in rural communities having access to, having cheaper access to an alternative provider. But it was, I think, more the arguments made in a couple of submissions about, particularly about KMH, things like the patient record system, other equipment within the hospital, that was less relevant to the arguments, or to the points being discussed as part of the select committee.
Yes, I absolutely agree. The hospital as part of FIG is exempt from the licensing requirements.
Okay.
I didn't know if David had anything to add on that.
David, did you have anything to add?
No, I don't think so. I perhaps should. Perhaps one thing is to say, if the hospital needed enhanced broadband facilities today, it can still obtain those through from SURE with on bespoke deals and arrangements, and that applies also to other aspects of FIG.
Okay.
Good point.
Yeah. Good point. Thanks. Leona.
Yes. Again, sorry, Davina, it's for you, or perhaps it's one that would be better addressed by the regulator in the later session, I don't know. But a number of the submissions make reference to constitutional rights. Are you able to set the facts out around that and just add some clarity to what are constitutional rights and where there might be some misunderstanding or misinterpretation, just so that people are very clear on that point?
Yes, of course. Obviously, the Falkland Island Constitution does protect various fundamental rights, such as the right to life, right to family life, freedom of communications. But where there are fundamental human rights, there are provisions that allow for those rights to be compromised where it's reasonable and proportionate to do so in a democratic society. So to give you examples, in terms of a right for life, that doesn't prevent a medical service having guidance in place that sets limits on the type of medication they would prescribe or the cost of that, or to give you what is often quite an easily understandable example, where people are in need of IVF, that they are funded for a certain number of cycles of that. So you do always have to bear in mind that although there are fundamental human rights, there are circumstances in a democratic society where, if it's provided it's reasonable and proportionate, those rights can be compromised in pursuit of the greater good.
Okay. Thanks. Mark.
Yeah. So, again, given that, you know, I've an awful lot of questions, but mainly coming out of the submissions, but for you know, particularly for the Attorney General / regulator and for SURE themselves. But I wanted to ask David, in particular, what So. Could you offer any clarity on how the regulator currently monitors the performance of SURE's internet service in terms of speed, reliability, and customer satisfaction? Are there established benchmarks or standards that SURE is required to meet, and do you feel these are adequate?
David.
Yeah, I can provide some information on that at least. SURE is required to provide quarterly reports on the performance of its network on various aspects, whether it's in faults, availability, and includes measurements of line speed from the so there is a quarterly submission of information. On the basis of that, some key performance indicators, some targets have been set, and those are reported on.
I'm still in warrior.
Sorry, Chair, can we ask Pete to mute his...
Pete, can Pete mute his...
Yeah.
Can you mute yours, Pete, please?
Yeah, sorry about that. I just had a bit of a problem with my picture.
If you can mute it, mute yours, Pete. You're coming out over the loudspeaker.
Okay,
David.
That, I think, was describing the process. I think the second part of your question, Mark, was about whether they were sufficient or adequate. I didn't quite catch the
Sorry, David. There were sort of three questions, really. So the first one was about the, you know, how. The other one is you know, whether or not there are established benchmarks or standards that they're required to meet. I guess that's the KPIs that you're talking about. And the third part was whether or not you felt these were adequate.
I guess what does a question what adequate means here? I mean, it's fairly evident from all the submissions that we've been looking at that they're not meeting user expectations or hopes. But there's a question also about what's technically possible with the infrastructure and the backhaul arrangements that Shure has in place. So I think on the first one, the user expectations probably not adequate, but in terms of what can be delivered with the infrastructure of today in use, I think they are adequate. They're probably no more than adequate, and then we would hope over time to improve them. But that would be my feel on it, I think.
Thank you.
Jack.
There is a...
And if you can speak up.
I will do my... I don't need a microphone. There's a question in submission 8 that from one of the members of the Starlink petition group that asks if the... I believe if the presentation made by the petition group, I think referring to the presentation where they... that included the handover of the petition to the chair... could be submitted to the select committee as evidence, and whether or not that has been done, or could be done at a later stage to include it on the record.
Right. Yes.
Well, the committee is welcome to accept anything
yes.
in evidence
yeah, well,
that it considers is relevant to the subject under discussion. I mean, obviously, I would imagine you wouldn't want people to put in some evidence that related to something the Legislative Assembly hadn't referred to you to look at, because that would be outside your remit.
But it was just as a submission from one of the members of the group that organised the petition, asking that the presentation that was quite a key
should
part of the handover
of
the petition
evidence.
Could be included in the evidence.
We'll ask the
it's a decision for you
yes.
as a committee if you want to accept that. I haven't looked at it recently, but from memory when I saw it, I think it did contain yeah. relevant information. So I wouldn't object to that. I don't know if Cherie has anything she wants to add to that.
Everybody happy to have that added to the
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, certainly. Tez, did you have anything more?
Teslan, do you have anything?
Sorry, just a bit of a delay while I'm trying the mute button to unmute myself. The question on, I think, the top of everyone's tongues is what effect would this have upon telecoms as a whole. I'm sure we'll get into that in a bit more detail later, but I'm happy with the questions that my colleagues have provided.
Thanks very much. Leona, did you have another?
No, I don't. I have more that come from the submissions, which I would like to ask of Shore later on, but I don't think at this stage I have any further. I would just say, though, I think, you know, there were a really good number of submissions in here. The ones I find most compelling were those that had some sort of strong personal evidence included in them. But I think it's a useful start.
Mark?
No, I'm exactly the same. I've got further questions coming out of it, and would thank everyone for their submissions. They're really useful.
Yeah, no further questions in this
Jack, sorry.
On submission number 9 from the Chamber of Commerce, it mentions, I think importantly mentions that the business climate survey conducted over many years regularly raises telecommunications as a significant barrier to business growth and development, which I think is a useful point, and it might be useful if whether either copies of or sections of business climate surveys could be potentially submitted as well as evidence to support that statement, possibly. The Chamber also mentions newer technologies which are available to business to help them improve productivity and grow their and develop their businesses. And whether it, I don't think we have a representative from the Chamber, but if they could possibly provide examples of where their members have tried to access new technologies and been unable to due to the service provided by Shore or potential other services that they might be able to use were they able to access Starlink at a more affordable rate for their business.
Okay. Well, sorry, Chair, I meant to say earlier, just I think it's useful to highlight that that our expert David has provided a summary of all the
yes.
written evidence, and that a lot of it sort of have a lot of things in common. I mean, not everything, obviously, but it has given us an awful lot of questions for other sort of forum rather than so. Whilst it may seem like we're glossing over all of the submissions, we're really not. It's they have been factored into questions that will come further down the line of the regulator when he's back in front of the select committee. So there will be a lot of questions coming out of it, even though this section is fairly short.
And I think these are available on the website, aren't they, Cherie? Yeah. Thanks.
Can I, on the petition presentation, can I request that somebody from the group provides me with that presentation so that I can include it in the evidence, because I don't have a copy. Thank you very much.
Good. Right, if there are no further questions, perhaps we should just mention on the Starlink submission, which has come in, that the Chief Executive has an email back from Starlink, which I think perhaps if we can enter into the record, Cherie, saying that they have tried to find any original documentation relating to their comment, and other than the notes that reflect this, I have not been able to directly verify. Unfortunately, the person who originally reached out is no longer here, so I cannot get any further information. This is the comment that they had been told they wouldn't be granted a license. I'm more than happy to clarify my statement. That is, the information that I have and possibly is not completely accurate according to your information here. The notes certainly could have been generalized interpretation of blocked without additional detail, which would include the exclusivity of the incumbent telco, no option for a full service license, etc. So we'll be asking for further clarification on that, but that's the present issue with the Starlink letter that on where they said that they were informed they couldn't apply for a license. And we also await a reply from the regulator when he returns, because there is a letter there which I think, David, you might be able to elaborate on.
Yes, I mean, I think this is a question probably has to be put to the regulator at a subsequent session, but I do know he wrote to Starlink some months ago in response to an earlier request from them about whether it would be possible to seek or apply for a license. And as far as I know, within that letter there was an openness to discuss it. So I think the statement in Starlink's submission is slightly more, it's a closed statement that says they were led in one direction. I don't think that was actually factually accurate. They may have interpreted it in that way, but the door was left ajar for further discussion, which hasn't, as far as I know, happened since then.
Thank you very much. Thanks. Jack?
It was more sort of similar to the owners, more of a, I think, probably as the summary of the submissions, and I think there are some really useful points made in a number of submissions that range from things like people's inability to access, whether it's education or continued professional development, access to new sort of software for things like maintaining and servicing plant and other equipment. Again, we've already touched on things like resilience and emergency contact and having a backup in places like camp and the importance of that. The impact on businesses and potential diversification of the economy and branching out into different, the development of different services that we don't have in the Falklands because of the limitations of the internet provision by shore. Also a number of, I suppose, personal submissions where it's impacting family life and their children as well, which are useful pieces of evidence. Also things on, there was a camp submission, I think submission 24, that touched on things like technologies to improve the efficiency of their farming business, but also the development of their tourism business, and the provision by shore either prevents that or severely limits the things that they can use to improve the efficiency of their business or expand into new areas. So I think it's there are a number of very useful personal pieces of evidence, but also then pieces of evidence from businesses or representatives of the business community that show how they're either being held back or are having to pay a significant cost if they choose to apply for a license to obtain something like a Starlink. That where if the fee were to be reduced, that would significantly benefit them personally or their business or the development of their business. So I think that's, despite a couple of criticisms of points made in some submissions, there are a number of very important points made.
Mark?
Yeah, just perhaps a brief question for Davina here in terms of we talk about Starlink and that is the sort of technology or the provider that we've been focusing on, but were we to reduce a fee or amend the fee for VSAT access, can you perhaps just offer the clarity that it wouldn't be necessarily for Starlink, it would be, you know, technology agnostic or provider agnostic perhaps?
That's my understanding, yes, that Starlink is one commercial provider and that others do exist.
Thank you.
It's self-provision, isn't it?
Yes,
that's,
We've got a question from Teslan. Go ahead, Tess.
Sorry about that. I think first I'd like to say I think the point made there earlier by Mateo around Starlink's understanding of the current situation of the exclusive license with Shore is not, and continues not to be what was the understanding of this Legislative Assembly or the previous one. And I suppose the question originally was going to be around, more towards Davina, to outline again the policy reasons behind the decision taken by the 2013-2017 Legislative Assembly to set the fee, the VSAT fee at the 5,400 level, at the disproportionately high level. As has been, I think, alluded to by M&A Ford there, obviously that being disproportionately high, it does push, does create further barriers for kind of social inequality in terms of certainly people who can't afford large packages, people who can't afford a VSAT fee are pushed towards the edge of not being able to live their lives to the best possible economic or social participation level. And that does kind of create societal problems as well as economic, as alluded to. It was really for Davina to outline and for the purpose of the committee to understand why that fee was set to the level that it was and whether those policy reasons, so that we can test whether those policy reasons continue to stand up to the very large and very, voluminous amounts of evidence that's been provided to the committee. And I'd also like to extend my thanks to everybody who's submitted to the committee so far.
Davina.
Thank you, Chair. I've had the benefit of reading back a report which went to EXCO 26th of October 2016, and that clearly sets out the policy reason as being that self-provision would be available at a fee that would effectively discourage self-provision, because if it was false, that would compensate the public interest for anyone who acted outside the regime under which there be an exclusive licence for one provider. I think the position at that point was the technology was such it was felt there was great strength in having one exclusive provider, especially given the fact that the number of users on the Falkland Island are relatively limited, and it was felt that would be the best way of achieving the best service for all, for the maximum number of people. Obviously, I wasn't with FIG then. Many of the MLAs were, so they can probably comment on that much better than I can.
Can I just comment? I wasn't an MLA at the time, but actually I think one of the reasons was that Shaw were not in receipt of any public funds. They were providing the camp system, and they were in receipt of no public subsidy or assistance at the time. And it was felt that that was... I think that was the reasoning, and Gavin can correct me, who was an MLA at the time, but I think that was the reasoning behind that decision, was in order that they had to support the camp network. That was one of the reasons given, but that they had that level of protection from self-provision, whereas now we know that the situation is quite different. There is a considerable size subsidy paid by FIG for this service. But Gavin, you can correct me.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, you summed it up absolutely perfectly, as my memory goes of those days. That was the idea, was to try and keep a universal coverage across the whole of the Falklands. And it was based on the world that we found ourselves in at that stage and the situation we were in. But as you say, things have now moved on. If I could just make one more observation. Sorry, my lack of questioning on any of the submissions, I hope, are not seen as lack of interest on my part. As I say, I have read through them, and I find the vast majority to be very well thought out and argument succinctly put. And I also would like to pay particular tribute to those from the rural sector who I think have actually laid out a very, very good case, especially Submission 7.
David, did you have any comments on that at all?
I'm not quite sure. I think the statements of why the fee was set, where it was set, are, as I understand it, exactly as expressed. I think we need to remember that at that point in time, it was not straightforward, it's not easy to any operator to come and provide services in the Falkland Islands and make the investments that were needed. And so part of this clear strategy to dissuade people from self-provision was to enable the investments to be made and for an operator to be willing to take on that license obligation. That was the other side of it, and of course that obligation and that license continues to function today.
Chair, I've got Tez and want them to come in again.
Yeah.
Tez, come in.
Tez, yeah.
Thank you. And I appreciate it is rather a basic question, and I know one that this Assembly has probably put to officers a number of times over, but I think it does really highlight the purpose. It brings us back to this point of, yes, at that specific point in time, maybe it made sense, and now the landscape has changed. And I'd like to thank the responses from Davina and from David there, and also from the Chair and Gavin for expanding upon that broader picture. Because that point about the resilience of camp services and the whole nation being able to be in receipt of internet provision to a level that was expected to improve over a timeline is something that the Select Committee is going to have to scrutinise time and again to address the evidence that's been submitted. for this new point in time. So I appreciate that. I think it's hopefully helpful for the grounding context of where this point is going.
Good.
Okay, anyone else? No? Right, okay. Anything else that we need to do? Shall we take a break? So if we...
From Pete or John, I guess.
Pete and John, have you got anything?
John
does. Pete?
I'm listening, Chair. It's very poor, but I can get the gist of most of it. And I've nothing to add at the moment. I think everybody's on the same transportation. We want to improve the service. And that's all I have to say.
Pete?
as far as I'm concerned, I'm more or less... in the same position as John. I'm very impressed with everybody that's made submissions and thought through the issues and made very good arguments. Nothing else constructive to add at this point. Thank you.
Good. Okay, well, I would suggest that we perhaps... thanks very much. We'll recommence now, and I'd like to thank Brian Jameson, who's come to give oral evidence for 10 minutes and then 10 minutes questions and answers afterwards. So thank you very much, Brian, for coming in, and thank you for your submission in advance as well.
Thank you, Chair. Just prior to doing my submission, can I clarify something from David Rogerson's summarising of the written evidence. He was hoping that if anyone had any particular issues that they might seek clarification. For written evidence 19, which was mine, MLAs had given verbal assurances that concerns raised by Dr. Elsby, that if the provider cannot provide what's required, then you shouldn't be penalised for that. He was speaking to the fee of £5,400 if you could demonstrate that you really needed a performance, a connectivity that Sure couldn't provide. excuse me. The other thing is that we were talking just before the break that Sure were taking the position that their collective purchasing provided benefits for the population at large. I would query that prior to the exclusive licence, there were two personal VSAT users in Stanley from several years ago, and they were enjoying quota-free evenings and quota-free weekends, while Sure, with its collective purchasing, took much longer to provide the benefit of quota-free antisocial hours. Thank you.
Okay.
Chair, members of the Legislative Assembly, and ladies and gentlemen, you've heard from many individuals who have chosen to write into the committee regarding telecommunications issues. You've certainly got many signatories who may be unsure of speaking or writing in, but feel that putting their name, occasionally several times over, to the petition is the best that they can offer. The petition garnered some 2,416 signatures. To put that into context, the referendum in 2013 had 1,518 votes cast. I think at this point it's appropriate to summarise the issues of pre-2024 communications on my attempts to earn a living in West Falklands and work as a so-called digital nomad. I only needed a personal computer and a reliable and reasonably speedy internet connection. What can be wrong with that as a life plan? It became clear quite rapidly that cable and wireless, as Sure South Atlantic was known then, was not set up to offer anything other than the most rudimentary internet services for Falkland businesses. Even mailboxes have incredibly stringent storage quotas applied to them. Here is an example that has affected everyone who has offered website services, such as myself. If you want to use Sure to host the website, if it's anything other than a simple text-based website with a few images, you're basically bogged in a ditch because of the inadequate services offered by Sure. You cannot install a required database, and just like email storage, you don't even get the disk space that a system like Joomla or WordPress requires. Prior to the outbreak of COVID-19, I created an application server based on a classroom scenario. Its uses include chat rooms, presentations, tests, polls, interactive whiteboards, and so on. All ideal applications allowing a scattered population to maintain recreational, educational, and work contact. I was able to demonstrate it to the regulator, to some MLAs, FIDC, the Chamber of Commerce, and the Education Department. It was very apparent that I needed significantly better upload speeds than those available from Sure. After well over a year of delays, the regulator accepted that I had indeed attempted to engage with Sure concerning my requirements. If you find yourself lucky enough to have a job as a content creator, such as a games programmer, a Formula One commentator, a drone pilot, or our favourite hospital scanner operators, Sure's services, even to this day, remain inadequate for your needs. Even the new packages announced by Sure last week still only have 1,000 kilobits per second upload speed, and that's at the very best, making its use practically impossible for content creators like me. This is a connection rate from the last millennium. Sure can now offer 15 megabits per second download speeds, so why can't they provide reasonable upload speeds? There are two key reasons that I'm certain Sure will discuss with you, perhaps even in the closed session this afternoon. The Starlink petition group predicted three main benefits for non-Starlink users: reduced network connection, enhanced reliability and stability, and competitive pricing. Sure's new tariffs show an incredibly welcome first step for consumers. The top two most expensive tariffs have effectively been removed, and the replacement is now quota-free at £3,840 per year. Sadly, the four most affordable tariffs remain the four most affordable tariffs are still constrained by monthly quotas and low speed. Time will tell if stability and reliability have been improved and if month-end congestion has actually been reduced. Sadly, as I said, as a content creator, the upload speeds remain too poor for Sure to be useful for my requirements. I was lucky enough to get a test and trial license of Starlink. I got to travel around the East and the West to take performance measurements and to get an understanding just how reliable and useful a mobile Starlink dish could be. It was a fantastic experience. Being out in the sticks, but being able to access the myriad services of the internet now presents new commercial opportunities for farmers and tourism, not to mention the clear benefits for the emergency services. I also managed to test some modern and all too common cloud-based applications. QuickBooks is a popular accounts package that now lives wholesale in the cloud. Modern task management and order processing software all work in the cloud and all require fast download and upload speeds. Any small company trying to improve itself and its processes simply must embrace the cloud. It is rare for business applications to operate offline these days. Accessing a file server at South Harbour when I'm in Stanley underscores the problems of the low upload speeds that are still in place. In Written Evidence 31, Shure concedes the existence of self-provision of internet written into the legislation. They note that applicants need to provide evidence that they have engaged with Shure. I tried just this, and I have an email trail stretching for 497 days in total. I suggest that sticking your head in the sand is not a good way to handle professional requests from customers. Shure suggests that allowing other service providers to operate is incompatible with the legislation. How do they expect a personal VSAT licence that's been issued by the government to operate? To be fair, the bulk of accounts belong to people who do not own or operate their own email or application servers or need to run VPN access points. These people are unlikely to want to make the jump to self-provision of internet and will remain customers of Shure, alongside the majority of those who have already indicated that they would prefer to retain their Shure package alongside a second ISP. By permitting taxpayers to choose their own ISP, not only do we reduce network congestion and contention, but we also allow individuals to build redundancy into their systems. This is of particular benefit to camp residents who are a long way from help, be it for power systems, for vehicles, or telecoms. Would no longer be constrained to wait for engineers to troubleshoot and swap out faulty hardware. The current service level agreement for camp allows for several days leeway to fix faults, understandably. It's a long time to go without communications. Having a second ISP could quite literally be a lifesaver. If you permit a second internet provider to operate under the existing legislation, then, as Margaret Thatcher might say, you're actually allowing effective regulation, and Shure will continue to up their game. Starlink has demonstrated its flexibility and reliability all around the globe, and I would ask that you treat the petition's requests in a favourable manner and allow me and others to earn a decent living once again by using the skills that we have worked hard to attain. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Gavin first.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Mr. Jameson, for coming along and presenting to the Select Committee this morning. We very much do appreciate it.
Thank you, Gavin.
Perhaps just a point of clarification before I begin, sir. You mentioned right at the beginning the number of signatures on the petition as versus the referendum.
Yeah.
Just for a point of clarity, really, or clarification, of course, the referendum itself was tied into registered voters only, whereas the petition was open to everyone, hence you will get a much higher...
That's absolutely...
But I do not wish to take away, or please don't think I'm criticising the petition in any way, shape or form.
If I might reply to that. You're absolutely correct. Stanley, if you drill down into the figures for the signatures, I wasn't allowed to drill down into the figures on the referendum, but if you drill down into the figures for the petition, Stanley supplied some 1,482 signatures and Camp supplied 185. So the grand number of signatures from us was 1,699.
Mark, and then perhaps if we ask the people on the...
So I think it looks like Gavin has a follow-up.
Yes, I did actually have my substantive question. In your petition, you mention that the fee should either be set to zero or a maximum of £180. I was just curious as to why a maximum of £180. Where did that figure come from?
What we were trying to do, and this is now going back to when we were trying to figure out the aims of the petition, we had perhaps a faulty understanding that the licence fee would be given to Shure as compensation for our skedaddling to another ISP. At that point, we also learned that the 5,400 had come from Shure basically saying we want to get the maximum that we're actually allowed to levy against customers before we then allow people to go off and self-provide. We took, oddly enough, the opposite view, which would be if Shure is absolutely unable to provide the service we need, then by all means we can compensate them, but it really ought to be the cheapest level. Why would anyone compensate for a service that is absolutely no use to them and is demonstrably no use to them?
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Mark.
Yeah, I think just on the comparison between... Sorry, thank you for coming, Brian, and thank you for your written evidence as well as your oral evidence. That was very succinct in your presentation. I think in terms of comparing the amount of Stanley and Camp and signing the petition and against people voting, obviously you have to have Falkland status to vote. You have to be above 18 years of age or 18 and above. So I think there are different factors there. It's not necessarily apples with apples, but when it comes to comparison. But I understand the point you're making. But there's one thing you said there that just I thought had been checked, but perhaps I'm wrong, and I'm not entirely sure who I'm asking this question of. But you said about the, sometimes people sign the petition several times over. I thought we'd sort of verified to check that they were individual signatures.
Those figures had been culled. We were actually thinking of offering a prize to the most persistent signature, but we decided that might not be a sensible idea.
But the total number are individuals rather than. People signing it many times over.
Anything that was deemed as multiples or eligibles and so on, they were excluded.
I think.
Thank you. Yeah, that was good.
Off memory, I think there were 300 or 400 that had been removed.
That's correct.
Yes.
Okay. So, that's an important clarification, I think. Thanks.
Did you want to ask Tez? Tez?
Tez, do you want to come in?
Thank you. Thank you, Brian, for your submission and for your work in gathering evidence for this petition. I hope you can all hear me correctly. I think first I'd like to highlight a comment that you made about resilience and safety, particularly for the island-wide network that we have in the Falklands. It certainly weighs heavy in my mind as a representative that there are areas and communities and families out there who can go days on end without any kind of telecom provision available, and not just in terms of the damage that does to them socially and to their business, but also the risk that it puts them under in terms of should anything happen to them in an emergency. And so that is a grave concern, I'd say, in the back of my mind. Certainly something that will continue to sit in my mind as a representative as we think about whether the policy expectations of the exclusive licence were have been delivered to an appropriate level in terms of camp provision. So I'd like to thank you first for highlighting that, which does put a very ethical lens around the petition, as well as the other aspects of whether economically it's fit for the Falklands. Not so much a question, but more a comment, which I think also that you've probably alluded to there in response to Gavin's question around why the £180 level. But in the spirits behind this petition, to be able to word the question in such a way to bring about a result that will address what are a wide range of different issues with telecoms in the islands. And I appreciate it was probably a difficult thing to try to task and sculpt the question accordingly that you posed in the petition. But whether there was anything more you could give to the context of why that question is worded in the way that it was. Like I say, you've addressed some of it already, but I did most want to thank you for highlighting the kind of ethical struggles of people in camp in particular.
Thank you, Teslin. I had a very interesting opportunity that sadly got kiboshed by, of all things, avian flu, and it was to actually get on the boat and take my Starlink dish to Steeple Jason and actually take it and test it there. As I say, sadly that was not to be. My fondest wish is to get on the boat and go there and just show exactly that Dishy is able to perform and keep people in touch. I had some information that there was a scientist who found herself on Steeple and hadn't actually appreciated quite how isolated she was going to be, or maybe the actual day-to-day realities were more than she was prepared for. And apparently the satellite phone that she had was not desperately functional and, of course, incredibly expensive. When I moved to the Falklands, my family and my friends were asking me, my God, how are you going to cope with the isolation? To which my reply was, look at my life. It is all wrapped up within that 2 foot square of a laptop monitor that we all work with day in, day out. I really don't think I'm going to be isolated. So I think that scientist on Steeple Jason, if they had been able to make use of a Starlink dish, they would not have found themselves feeling quite as isolated as they otherwise do. We also know that the recent road traffic accident that was close to Onion Range had quite a lot of fallout of problems due to connectivity. More than I'm necessarily able to talk about. But all of these things figure into allowing emergency services to make best use of the best resources that are available right now. Nobody complains about a fast jet taking people across to medical evacuations. Why would we be upset if emergency services and so on were able to make use of miniature Starlink dishes attached by magnets to the roof of the cars? I, for one, would actually be highly comforted by that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Did John or Pete have anything they wanted to ask? John, Pete, anything?
Yes, thank you, Roger. I would like to thank Brian Jameson for his excellent talk, highlighting the technicalities, advantages of having 21st century communications available as widely as possible in the Falklands. I thought it was a great eloquent explanation of those technicalities. But underlying all that for me is a moral or ethical issue, really. That's the thing that troubles me most, is the fact that the moral and ethical issues underlying, a clause in the contract denying a population the benefits of top-notch 21st century technology. I'll just leave it at that. Thank you.
John, have anything? Or?
Yeah. Thank you very much. Yeah, thank you, Brian. That was very interesting. I'm going to get boring about this. We're all on the same transport. We all want to improve the service, so I think we are getting in the right direction. Thank you.
I did have just one question for Brian. Just on reliability of the, have you provided any statistics on the reliability of the Starlink test thing that you have, and could those be made available to the select committee perhaps? We can compare
I would be delighted to forward that information to you.
Mark?
Yeah, just a couple of, I think clarification from Davina probably, or from yourself, Chair, in the first one, in that so Brian's made some very sort of specific claims about put some clear sort of on the table about some of the issues he's faced and put some evidence behind it, in terms of the 400 odd days it took of correspondence. And I'm just aware that that Sean may be wishing to refute some of that, but how do we avoid getting stuck into a loop of backwards and forwards between, for example, if they're refuting each other's evidence? So that's just a question of procedure, if I may. And the other one is just on the emergency services. Presumably FIG can utilise that anyway, as the being exempt. I think that's the case, isn't it?
If you'd like me to answer that, Chair, taking the second question first, FIG are exempt for requirements for a licence. I personally am not aware of what the actual arrangements are within DSIS, between the police and the hospital, the ambulance service and everything around how they utilise technology that's available to them. I know that after various incidents that have taken place recently, reviews are taking place of what happened and what we can learn from that and what could be done to improve the situation. So I'm sure proposals would come forward coming out of those reviews, but I don't know any of the detail around that. I'm sorry.
I think just on that, I'm not entirely comfortable that we are exempt, but I understand why in some cases we may be. But the other one about the procedure for...
Yes, obviously procedure is a matter for the committee for you to decide, and there are various options. If you wished, you could allow Shaw the opportunity to ask questions of Brian, if Brian were happy to answer them. Alternatively, Shaw, when they get their chance to put their submissions, can just address what Brian has said, make any points they wish to make, and you as the committee then have to weigh up the evidence that's been put to you and take a view on that and decide what weight you're going to put on what's been said and what you think is correct. And you can do that with the benefit of advice from David Rogerson as our technical expert and advice from me on law and procedure. So it's a matter for you to decide which of those two routes you'd like to go down. But obviously you cannot require anyone to answer questions if they do not wish to do so.
Absolutely.
I would be delighted to make myself available.
Okay. Kevin, just
Thank you, Chair. Just perhaps for an old dinosaur like me.
Let's not get into a competition, Gavin.
you talk of the use of Starlink for use by the emergency services. Now, does this mean you have to cart a generator around with you to fire this thing up, or can you just? Or does it run off 12 volt? And the other thing is, can you operate a telephone over this?
So, thanks for those questions, Gavin. They're brilliant. First of all, you can run effectively a mains-powered Starlink dish. The sort of thing that you've probably seen on the Lilibet and what you saw at the petition. Those are run from a 13-amp plug, and in fact you can run that off an inverter that is attached to your car battery. And that's precisely how I was zooming around left, right and centre to take my readings. Starlink have just recently made generally available a dish which is referred to as a Starlink mini dish. And the mini dish is just about the size of one of your laptop screens, maybe an inch and a half deep, and that can actually run off a DeWalt drill battery if you felt so inclined. So the flexibility of power of the new Starlink dishes is just phenomenal. You do not need to take. It's not like living at South Harbour where you need two generators and maybe a standby, building site generator. This is far more eloquent.
Absolutely. And can you at this stage make a telephone call through that device, or is it just in?
So actually, you can. There are two things that I've been chasing for. One is a system that you may have seen on your mobile phones, and it's referred to as Wi-Fi calling. And basically, if you have a Wi-Fi signal, if you're attached to the internet, but you don't have a mobile phone signal, Wi-Fi calling enables your phone to piggyback off your internet connection to allow you to use your phone in a transparent manner. Sure have apparently investigated this, and there seem to be issues about trying to enable that here in Falklands. South Harbour exists in a bit of a Wi-Fi telecoms radio shadow, and FIG sent out to us a thing called a BTS cell, and it's a tiny little box. It has two inputs. It has a 12 volt supply, and it has an Ethernet plug that you attach to your internet router. When you've got that on, after a while you get a mobile phone signal, and you can then use your mobile phone to make calls or, crucially, to pick up SMS messages to verify login procedures from banks and so forth. That works. I would say it works problematically. The thing, you need to basically power it on and off almost on a daily basis, sometimes two or three times a day. But once you've got a signal, you can then, you need to be a bit premeditated, get this signal up and running, and then go and do your internet shopping and get the verification code sent to you. But it is possible to do that. And I've done that successfully.
Brilliant. No, thank you very much for the clarification.
Fair enough.
Thanks. And thank you again, Brian, for both your written and your oral evidence here today. It's been really interesting. I think I have absolutely no doubt that there are a very long list, a myriad of reasons and benefits that would come from having other, you know, very modern, very flexible and mobile services available, as you've described. I think there's, you know, I think anyone would struggle to say that it wouldn't be a positive thing in terms of allowing us to live differently, actually. I guess one of my questions that comes out of the submission is to what extent do you think it's generally understood what FIG's responsibility would be for security, for service issues, for license fees, etc., should regulatory approval be given for another service? Because I think something I've picked up from conversations with people and as well in some of the submissions, there seem to be mixed levels of understanding, should we say.
So, excuse me, when I got the test and trial license, at that time, the only service that I could sensibly make use of was a tariff that was referred to as global roaming tariff, and that came in at the price of £200 per month. towards the end of the year, Starlink had announced that the global tariff was going to go up to £380 per month, which was a little bit of a shock. At the same time, what they were actually doing was they were rationalising their tariffs right across the board, and they have several. They have several for so-called residential, and they have several for mobile and business use. For particular business use, where you want to take a dish onto something like a jet aircraft or what have you, onto a train journey that you're taking from London to Scotland, you don't actually need to because they've got free Wi-Fi anyway. But anything where you're using what people might consider exceptional use, in other words, you're using it while the vehicle that you're in is moving, is travelling, or if you're using it out in the middle of the ocean, those sorts of tariffs, surprisingly enough, Starlink are going to make you pay for that. For residential tariffs right around the world, Starlink has always positioned itself as being a disruptive service and really trying to make best use of the coverage that they have right around the globe. And it makes sense to make it as easy as possible for as many people as possible to use that service. So naturally, they actually try to make that service as cheap as they possibly can. So, for example, in the UK, a residential service static at your home would be something like £80. It used to be £100, so they've knocked £20 off that. In Chile, the equivalent service started out at being something like 60 Chilean dollars, and now it's gone up to, I think, 80 or something like that. They had really tried hard to get into the market in Chile, and in fact, the amount of engineering effort that Starlink put into Chile was quite extraordinary because they've got 6 ground stations that go right down the backbone of the Andes, and the one that we were waiting for desperately to come online was the one at Punta Arenas, and that's the ground station that we connect to. That's the nearest one that we can connect to. And by all accounts, and certainly by my testing, that has been giving results that are comparable, if not better, than the service elsewhere in the world. I haven't yet got any figures for Antarctica, sure. But I'm working on it.
Yes, yeah, sorry, Brian. I think what I was really trying to get to was, do you think that, I guess, in the last few years as being an MLA, one thing I've learned is that whenever there's a problem with anything, people say, what are government going to do about it? And do you think it is broadly understood that Bougain Island's government should regulatory approval be given and these services start moving in, that actually government's role in remedying issues would probably be very limited, if at all?
When you say remedying issues, are you meaning if my Starlink dish gets broken?
Anything around those things. I think, you know, certainly I have a view on that, but I have heard different views. I've heard, and even in some of the submissions, it's sort of hinted at, well, the government could support, government would liaise with Starlink and sort these things. And I think just, you know, this is really for public understanding that I'm trying to draw this out. Because as I understand it, please correct me if I'm wrong,
okay,
there would not be a role for government in that.
I do not think that should be a role for government.
Absolutely.
I don't think that was a role for government even when the people who self-supplied the personal VSATs were in that situation. And if a cow breaks the dish in the field or what have you, that's up to them to fix. That's no different from having to fix your own punctures in the vehicle. You know, but government made the road, it's their fault. No, not really. Come on, that's not sensible. So I agree with you. That's not for government to get involved.
And I do
there.
Think it's just it's important that is something that's understood and considered. It's you know, I think the default position tends to be to come to government for a solution and not prejudging anything, but just saying that, you know, I think to be clear that would not be government.
I think it's far more an opportunity for small companies who are going to be responsive and reactive enough to be able to go and listen to what someone's particular needs are, to look at how they might need to position a dish on their house so that the cat doesn't chew the cable or anything like that. I think that's... I'm not going to look to you to go up on the roof and fix.
Good thing. Yeah, thank you, Brian.
Good. Okay, I'm just very conscious... You've probably gone over the time for...
I've got Tez on the call.
Tez, one more? Yeah. Okay. Are you happy? I mean...
Thank you. Actually, the answer to Leona's question there leads quite neatly into mine, which you kind of blurred the lines with, which was, well, first to ask what or to compare, if you could please, your experience of the benefits of having customer services... for sure on the line with an office in place in the Falklands versus the customer services experience that you can enjoy through Starlink. Honestly, hearing about Starlink secondhand in the way that I have been, my experience of, like, if there are to be issues, to use your example, if a cat chews through a cable or if the service is disrupted in some way, what would be the chain to escalate that for some kind of remedy through Starlink? But also, I think that the broader point about that Leona's question was a kind of bubbled up, which would be the changing scope of what FIG regulation and the regulator role should be if the exclusive license isn't the journey in the future. So then that. Probably more of a question for the government to then consider should that happen, but I'd expect that there would be a different view of what FIG should do as a regulator of telecoms, but perhaps a hypothetical later. But mostly that customer services experience, please speak to that on both sides.
I can speak to both aspects of that, because we've found ourselves with broken outside OBSs, I believe they're referred to, which has meant we've waited for a plane to take a unit to Bill Paul Evans at Port Howard, and then Bill's had to drive to the other end of the West in order to swap this out. So we've had issues which have been more than a day to be fixed. And that is simply that's life, that's the situation in camp, and that's where I spoke earlier about trying to always be aware of making a redundant system. Now, with Starlink, you have the added issue that if something goes wrong, if a cat chews through the cable, if the modem breaks, whatever, you've first of all got to raise a support call with Starlink. That can take a couple of days to resolve. I have actually made use of their support, and it took 4 days for that to be resolved. But because of the particular details of my system, they sent the replacement unit to Scotland, and then I got it DHL'd down to the Falklands. So it would make sense if Starlink was here, if companies were here and able to actually provide services, they would naturally buy in spare proprietary units to just swap in and out, and then they can take them, send them back to Starlink if they need to be refurbished or replaced or so on. Their support I have found is good, but at the same time, I am just like what I have with my Shure support, it can be delayed by days. The worst that we've had as a delay for pieces coming out was 10 days, but that is just a natural consequence of where we live, and we're aware of it. And there's no point in shouting at government to fix that. That's our problem. That's our choice.
Thank you very much, Brian.
Thanks.
Good. Nothing else from anybody? Brian, thank you very, very much indeed for coming and giving your evidence. Thank you very much, and we will close the meeting there and commence again at 1:30 for Shaw's evidence. So thank you very much indeed for coming. Thanks. Thanks to everybody else.
Thank you, everybody.
Thanks.